All right, hello. And yeah, I jumped up on my chair to close my blinds so you guys wouldn't be blinded by the light behind me. I like the blinds open, but when I teach, it's too much brightness behind me, so I have to close them. But it's good to see y'all. In fact, let me put it on gallery so I can see y'all. There you go. So we are here for Enlightened Leadership. And it's a good day for enlightened leadership, at least for Jacqueline. I hope she's listening. She's having a challenging day today, I think. A couple things haven't gone as expected. And, of course, she and I will go and work on those things later. But she's, you know, she's starting to learn what the president minister deals with. So it's a good day for some enlightened leadership. And Anne, you brought one of them to our attention. I don't know if you know, you said something about how we hadn't returned Rev Carroll's email. We found emails dating back to December 12th that were supposed to be forwarded to us from the server where the contact emails go that weren't. And we've been receiving some, so we didn't know we were missing some, right? If we had gotten none, we would have been suspicious. But some came to us and some didn't. And they did, I think they date all the way back till December 7th. So there's, you know, 50-ish emails that people wrote to us and we didn't respond to. And I can see one guy wrote to us like a bunch of times and then he gave up. So we need to do two things about that. One, we need to go back and respond to all those people. And two, we need to figure out what's wrong and get it fixed. And I spent, I don't know, an hour or so this morning trying to figure it out and I haven't figured it out yet. So we'll keep working on that. And the other stuff is just around the Awakening Together budget. So yeah, this is the kind of stuff that the president minister works with, the stuff that most people have no idea is even being worked with, right? All they see is, you know, what we do in the sanctuary or what we post on the website. They don't know anything about the rest of the job, and it's not always easy. And some of this stuff comes up when you already had a full day booked, right? And now you got to stop and deal with these things. So, so it's a good day for enlightened leadership. Don't you think, Jacqueline? Yeah. So I'm going to be looking at verse 45. This is Derek Lynn. Great perfection seems flawed. Its function is without failure. Great fullness seems empty. Its function is without exhaustion. Great straightness seems bent. Great skill seems unrefined. Great eloquence seems inarticulate. Stillness overcomes movement. Cold overcomes heat. Clear quietness is the standard of the world. So that was Derek Lynn. We'll have a peek at Dr. Wayne Dyer. The greatest perfection seems imperfect, and yet its use is inexhaustible. The greatest fullness seems empty, and yet its use is endless. Great straightness seems twisted. Great intelligence seems stupid. Great eloquence seems awkward. Great truth seems false. Great discussion seems silent. Activity conquers cold. Inactivity conquers heat. Stillness and tranquility set things in order in the universe. So they had actually quite a few differences. I would say the way that Wayne Dyer wrote it and the way Derek Lynn wrote it, they don't actually mean 100% the same thing. That's what's interesting about the Tao. That's why I always say someday I'll write my own Tao, but we'll see if that happens. But I did find, and I think I kept the link, I did find some place where they do a word-for-word translation using the characters. And what's interesting about the word-for-word translation using the characters is it doesn't really make sense. You can't read it because the characters back then, especially in ancient China, a character represented a picture which represented a thought. And so, you know, the exact translation is the picture. And it's almost like you need context to understand what the thought is. And so what happens, I think, when people translate it is they're trying to determine what that context is and then translate it into English with that context. And of course, I think they all end up with a similar, I don't think anybody is totally warped. You know, like I don't think anybody's like totally misinterpreted the Tao, or at least none of these guys, and gone off in a different direction. But you know, you can most definitely and honestly and genuinely get slightly different interpretations out of those picture characters. So that's why sometimes we see what appear to be great differences, or at least not really great difference, semi great difference. Let me look at Victor Mayer. He says, great perfection appears defective, but its usefulness is not diminished. Great fullness appears empty, but its usefulness is not impaired. Great straightness seems crooked. Great cleverness seems clumsy. Great triumph seems awkward. I totally agree with this statement. Bustling about vanquishes cold. Standing still vanquishes heat. That's just practical. If you're cold, start moving. If you're hot, stop moving. Pure and still, one can put things right everywhere under heaven. All right, so let's look at Stephen Mitchell, see what he did with this, and then we'll see where we want to dive in. True perfection seems imperfect, yet it is perfectly itself. True fullness seems empty, yet it is fully present. True straightness seems crooked. True wisdom seems foolish. True art seems artless. The master allows things to happen. She shapes events as they come. She steps out of the way and lets the Tao speak for itself. So I'm going to go back to Derek Lynn first. We'll start with Derek Lynn. Derek Lynn had I would say the other three were actually more closely together translated. It's interesting that Derek Lynn was a little more different this time, but we'll go ahead and start with Derek Lynn. The first sentence to me, which is the same in all of them, it's really important. And until a certain level of spiritual maturity occurs, it's very difficult to see or understand. Great perfection seems flawed. What that really means is that the world is always perfect exactly as it is. And of course, the mind doesn't accept that. I mean, the mind, oh my God, the things we can find to judge wrong with the world are endless. The things we could find, you know, I mentioned that today was kind of an interesting day. Things have been happening in a way. Of course, they weren't expected to happen. Jacqueline and I are going to have to rearrange our workload today. Instead of doing what we were planning to do, we're going to have to work on some other stuff, you know, which just changes everything. And a lot of people would say that's a day gone wrong, right? But this says it's a perfect day. And it is a perfect day. One way to see it as a perfect day is that it's a perfect opportunity to see that things do not have to go the way I think I need them to go in order for me to be perfectly at peace, perfectly happy, you know, perfectly calm, perfectly joyous. That's a really important lesson. You know, most people definitely have an idea in the mind that things need to go the way I think they need them to go in order for me to be happy. And so it's a perfect lesson when things don't go the way you think they were supposed to go. This is literally your opportunity to learn who you are, the unaffected self. Right? But they're not just perfect in that way. The world is a perfect reflection of our believing attention as a whole. In fact, it's impossible for the world to not be a perfect reflection of our believing attention. It's not like we're all believing one thing and something else is showing up. Whatever we're believing is showing up. And that's perfect. That's, you know, if this was a machine that we had built, it operates perfectly. So there's genuinely nothing but perfection here. And it appears to be flawed, you know, because we judge it, right? It appears not to be perfect. Like, you know, we can make a long list of things that appear not to be perfect. So great perfection, not just perfection, but great perfection. You know, imagine if you built a machine, if you were an engineer, and if you built a machine where when somebody believes something, a representation of that would show up like on a 3D printer, right? And if every time what they believe showed up on that 3D printer, that would be an amazing, that would be a great invention, right? Well, the world is kind of like that, just, you know, much more grand. So it's a great perfection, but it seems flawed. And the next line says, its function is without failure. And I totally agree with that. It never fails. This divine creative principle machine works perfectly. Great fullness seems empty. Well, of course, this is referring to the Tao itself. Right, the Tao itself. And the Tao does seem empty compared to this object-filled world. Right? But every single thing in this object-filled world ultimately comes from the Tao. You know, consciousness came from the Tao. The creative principle came from consciousness, and everything in the world came from the creative principle. So it's emptiness and not emptiness at the same time. I mean, it is emptiness. That's its ultimate nature. And yet it's the source of every single object you see. Its function is without exhaustion. You know, I don't know how Jacqueline is feeling today, but like I said, you know, this day is not going the way that, you know, our calendars thought it would go. And, you know, we have some work to do, and then all the work we were going to do is going to have to be squeezed in some cracks somewhere else, right? And I don't know, I have no idea how Jacqueline is feeling today, zero. So I'm about to make up a story, and I want to make that clear, all right? But, you know, just Sunday night, we announced that she's going to be the president minister. So, and then this day kind of hits. You know, I could imagine somebody saying, oh, my God, what did I get myself into? Oh, I don't want to do, right? I don't want to do this. This is way too hard. I had no idea what Regina was dealing with. I do not want to do this, right? I can just see that. That would be, you know, that would be a form of exhaustion. I don't want to do this anymore. It's not what I expected, right? But the Tao never gets exhausted. No matter how much we, pardon the language, abuse it. You know, the Tao, you could say, was meant for joy. That's what Inner Ramana says, that it was meant for joy. You know, the Tao becoming consciousness and consciousness creating the creative principle and the creative principle creating the world was meant for joy. Yet if we were to score the world on how well it's using the Tao for joy, it might get an F, at least a D, right? At least a D, it might get an F. So it's kind of like we're abusing the Tao. And yet it's not exhausted. It's not quitting. It's not saying this isn't what I expected. Right? It's too perfect for that. In fact, you guys may have heard this story before, but a very long time ago, I had kind of a vision. And in that vision, what I called the Holy Spirit at the time took me to a war scene. And in that war scene, it looked like some bombers had just flown over and just kind of blown this downtown area to bits. And what I saw was just all kinds of suffering, heartbreaking suffering. I mean, you know, there were buildings that were crumbled down. There were fires. There were dead bodies, you know, everywhere, you know, with missing limbs, lots of blood. Of course, some of those bodies were children. There were children who were severely injured but not dead. There were parents looking for their children, you know, and all this had just happened, you know, like, probably a second ago, these people were downtown shopping, and now this, right? It was awful from a human perspective. And then I was shifted into what I'll have to call formless. There was no longer anything to see, so I'll have to call it formlessness. But there was still a knowing. And the knowing was that we, as one mind, created that scene I had just seen, that war scene. But the interesting thing was, is I was seeing it with what I called Holy Spirit, 100% right mind. And there was such joy. There was nothing but perfect joy and gratitude that we were able to do that, that we were able to use this power that right now I'm calling the Tao, and create that war scene. You know, it's not anything that a human mind can really understand. The best way to explain it to the human mind is the joy was for the freedom that we had to do whatever we want. And it didn't judge based on what we did with it. Just the fact that we had the freedom and that we were using the freedom. So, yeah, you hate experience, Jacqueline writes. So that's what this means when it says its function is without exhaustion. You know, it doesn't say, wait a minute. No war. I'm not going to be used for that. I mean, how could it? It's not human. That's kind of projecting human thinking onto the Tao. But no matter what we do with it, no matter where our believing attention goes, the Tao is just going to keep right on providing that reflection perfectly. Great straightness seems bent. Again, the great straightness is how perfect this creative principle functions. I mean, it's just a perfect reflection. It's not at all skewed, but it appears very skewed. You know, like when people, you know, and of course we've heard this a lot. I haven't heard it recently, but, you know, over the years I've heard it, and I would imagine you've heard it too. You know, people saying things like, why would I create this cancer? Well, first of all, the idea that I, the individual, creates directly the experiences of my life is a little off, because you got to remember there is no separation. So it's more like a we-ness, right? A we-ness that creates the whole play without any favoritism about where certain experiences land. Like, it doesn't matter if it lands in Regina's life or Regina's body, or it lands in Shauna's life and Shauna's body. It just doesn't matter, because we're the same we-ness, you know? We see it from an individual point of view, but that's what's skewed. Everything that we create here no matter where it shows up or how it shows up, is an absolute perfection of what we are believing in. I mean, we could just pause for a moment and say, what do we believe in that maybe causes cancer? Well, one thing that we believe in is attack, right? Another thing that we believe in is that we are bodies. Another thing that we believe in is that we are vulnerable as bodies, that we are at risk of illness and death. Another thing that we believe in is that we are victims, right? That we're the victim of the world we see. There are things that we do not create. They just happen to us. I mean, cancer is a perfect reflection of each and every one of those beliefs. And I bet you a dollar there's more that I'm not sitting here thinking of that are a part of that creation. And the beliefs I just listed don't belong to one individual. Right? They belong to the we-ness as a whole. So great straightness seems bent, but it's a straight line, perfect reflection of what we believe in. Great skill seems unrefined. At least in my mind, and of course I'm not Lao Tzu, so I can't tell you exactly what Lao Tzu meant, but in my mind, he's taking a turn now. He was talking about the creative principle, and now he's talking about the master. You know, the master is the one who maybe appears to do nothing when everybody else thinks something needs to be done. You know, the master is the one who's not concerned or not worried about the thing that everybody else is concerned and worried about. Right? The master is the one with the grin on his face when everybody else say, there's nothing here to smile about. That's actually great skill. In fact, let me see if I can, I sent an email to Cheryl and Jacqueline yesterday, just something that I saw on Facebook that I thought they would enjoy. Let me see if I can find it, and if so, I'll read it to you because it really fits with this. New Zealand's richest person is a one-time truck driver and high school dropout. Just saw that headline while I was on my way. I thought that was kind of funny. So let me go to my sent messages. And let me go to, let me open it up and now I'll share my screen. I just, because I might have private stuff in email, I didn't want to share my screen before I opened up the email I wanted to share with you. Here we go. This is from Ramana Maharshi. This is what he said to Robert Adams. To be calm is the greatest asset in the world. The greatest siddhi, the greatest power you can have. And does anybody know, is siddhi, is that practice? That's what it translates in my mind.
Spiritual power.
Oh, spiritual power. Okay, spiritual power. Thank you. To be calm is the greatest asset in the world. It is the greatest spiritual power. And then he repeats it in English. The greatest power you can have. If you can only learn to be calm, you will solve every problem. This is something you must remember. When you are perfectly calm, time stops. There is no time. Karma stops. Samskaras stop, which is the what I think, I see, what I see, I experience, I think loop. Everything becomes null and void. For when you are calm, you are with the entire energy of the universe, and everything will go well with you. See, that's the skill that we're talking about right now, the skill of the master. But, you know, to the average person in the world, if we're being calm at a time where they judge we shouldn't be calm, well, that's pretty dang unrefined, right? So great skill seems unrefined. Great eloquence seems inarticulate. there's two ways that I understand that line. One is that great eloquence is completely inarticulate because great eloquence is silence. But also, you know, I notice, for example, when I'm writing with inner wisdom, sometimes Microsoft Word doesn't like what I'm writing. You know, it doesn't fit the structure of the English language, you know, talking about is, ising, and all that kind of stuff. You know, to some people, in fact, to all of us at one time, I think. I mean, how many of you guys have listened to people like Nisargadatta, Ramana Maharshi, you know, or any other teacher, read A Course in Miracles, and had absolutely at one time no idea what they were talking about? You know, it was completely inarticulate, right? Until your mind was prepared to understand it. So great, and it is great eloquence, right? Great eloquence seems inarticulate. Stillness overcomes movement. And that's really what Ramana Maharshi just said. In fact, let's just go back and look at Ramana Maharshi again. Stillness overcomes movement. Ramana Maharshi says, to be calm is the greatest asset in the world. Can you guys see my mom? She's her little, she says it's pouring there. she's ready to come back to Colorado. To be calm is the greatest asset in the world. It's the greatest spiritual power, the greatest power you can have. If you can only learn to be calm, you will solve every problem. This is something you must remember. When you are perfectly calm, time stops. There is no time. Karma stops. Samskaras stop. Everything becomes null and void. For when you are calm, you are one with the entire energy of the universe, and everything will go well with you. Right? That's exactly what this line says. Stillness overcomes movement. Now, the next one is a little more mysterious. You would have to understand what these words represent. It says cold overcomes heat. And you know, there's always symbols in language. And what I strongly suspect is that cold had a particular meaning and heat had a particular meaning that we may not really understand right now. And I'm not going to go about guessing. We know the flavor of the Tao. So we know that in some way, when it says cold overcomes heat, it's very similar to stillness overcomes movement. It might be something similar to dispassion overcomes excitement, right? Cold overcomes heat, that kind of might fit in there. But since we don't really know what these words symbolized in ancient China, we're kind of having to guess here. But I'm going to stick with just as an alternate possibility. Dispassion overcomes excitement. And then clear quietness is the standard of the world. And that would be for the master. Again, in the first part of this verse, I believe he was talking about the creative principle. And in the second part of the verse, he's talking about the master. Clear quietness is the standard of the world. This is for the master. I'm looking to see if there's a way to explain what I want to say. It's funny how I can know what I want to say and I have no words for it. There's a calm way of seeing that comes about at some point. It's a naturally calm way of seeing. You know, in the beginning, when you start practicing spiritual practice, you may get excited about something. And then you use spiritual practice to bring yourself to calm. What eventually happens, though, is there's just a calm way of seeing that becomes natural. So, you know, things, quote, go wrong, at least to everybody else. And there's a very calm and collected way of seeing that and you know, maybe doing something about it, maybe not doing something about it, depending on what it is. But that's what I think this is referring to, that clear quietness. It's that calm way of seeing. Clear quietness is the standard of the world. That's how the master sees the world. So I remember thinking that Wayne Dyer was a little different. So let's peek at Wayne and see if he had something to offer that that we didn't find in Derek Lynn. My nose is itching like crazy, so pardon me. Don't know why it's itching so much, but it's perfect. The great perfection seems imperfect, and yet its use is inexhaustible. So he just kind of moved that around a little bit. The great perfection seems imperfect, and yet its use is inexhaustible. The great fullness seems empty, and yet its use is endless. So again, the creative principle just keeps on pumping out whatever we're giving our believing attention to. Great straightness seems twisted. Great intelligence seems stupid. Great eloquence seems awkward. Here's something that he added that was not in the previous version. Great truth seems false. And I think this is absolutely true. You know, if we look at A Course in Miracles, Lesson 132, A Course in Miracles, Lesson 132 says basically that the real purpose of this course is to teach us that the world does not exist. Well, that doesn't seem true, does it? To the average person walking around the world, probably even still to most people on the spiritual path, that doesn't seem true at all. You know, we hear masters talk about like Bernadette Roberts and Ramana Maharshi, you know, they talk about how when you have awakened to the absolute, you don't even see a world. The world does not exist. Well, that doesn't seem true. So great truth seems false from our perspective, but it's called great truth. And then it says great discussion seems silent, you know, which I think is true. I think that was really the language of Ramana Maharshi. And although we know he spoke, there were many times that he was just silent, and there are all kinds of stories about the power of his silence. Now, instead of saying cold conquers heat, he says activity conquers cold, inactivity conquers heat. And again, without knowing what cold and heat mean, you know, we're guessing a little bit here. But if cold does mean dispassion, then activity conquers cold. That means getting involved, getting, you know, worried about the political situation, worried about the, you know, whatever is going on, we lose our dispassion. Inactivity conquers heat. If heat is the excitement, then choosing to stay back and be still, that's going to conquer that heat. Stillness and tranquility set things in order in the universe. That's exactly what Ramana Maharshi said. And I think that's really, there's only a little bit of difference here, not as much as I originally thought when I read it. So I'm going to go ahead and move on. I don't see any sense in continuing to read that same verse. I think we got it. So I'm going to move on to the 47th verse. Was that the 46th I was just reading? Make sure I didn't skip one. Nope, that was the 45th I was just reading. I did skip one. So we're going to the 46th verse. And I'm in Wayne Dyer just because he's in my lap now. So we'll stick with him first. When the world has the way, running horses are retired to till the fields. When the world lacks the way, war horses are bred in the countryside. There is no greater loss than losing the Tao, no greater curse than covetousness. no greater tragedy than discontentment. The worst of faults is wanting more, always. Contentment alone is enough. Indeed, the bliss of eternity can be found in your contentment. I think it's really funny. I remember how Stephen Mitchell translates the first part of this. I think it's really funny because he tries to modernize it, because this is talking about horses. let's listen to how he modernizes it. He says, when a country is in harmony with the Tao, the factories make trucks and tractors. When a country goes counter to the Tao, warheads are stockpiled outside the cities. That's kind of a modern update. So that when it's talking about the horses here, you got to remember back then, horses are what they took into battle. So this is saying that when a country is in harmony with the Tao, you know, the horses are just in the fields eating. I think some of the translations talk about how they're, of course, you know, they're dropping their manure in the fields, and so they're fertilizing the fields, right? Horses are fertilizing the fields, some of them say. But when the world is not in harmony with the Tao, those horses are bred to go to war. So it's interesting that this verse would follow the last verse, because remember the last verse talked about how everything is perfect, always. It's great perfection. And now this verse seems to say things can be not perfect. You could call this a paradox, but really it's not. What it's saying is that if we are out of harmony with the Tao, the stillness, this is the appearance that is made. When we are in harmony with the Tao, the stillness, this is the appearance that is made. It's not really saying one appearance is perfect and the other appearance is imperfect. That would be the judgment we put on it. You know, we're saying it's better for the horses to just be relaxing in the field than it is for the horses to go to war. This didn't say that. This is talking about that same perfection. It's saying when in harmony with the Tao, this is the reflection you'll see. When not in harmony with the Tao, this is the reflection that you'll see. So one way of looking at that is, because the world is a perfect reflection of our believing attention, we can see what we're believing by how we see the world. It's kind of like feedback. It does say there is no greater loss than losing the Tao. And what that really means is we will suffer from the reflections that come from being out of harmony. You know, if you believe in attack, you're going to suffer. In fact, you might even perceive yourself being attacked when you aren't. I mean, sure, certainly there are people out there that believe in attack, and one way they're acting it out is by attacking. You know, they come up to you and they tell you, you know, how stupid you are, how they don't like you. You know, sure, that happens. But sometimes people just say something without meaning it as an attack at all. Like, I remember hearing a story once, I can't remember who it was, maybe it was one of your stories, I don't know. I heard a story once about how, it might have been yours, Don, so I might get a little wrong, but it might have been your story, about how the boyfriend said something like, why didn't you go to the grocery store, or why didn't you buy more groceries, or something like that, and you got, you know, you took it as an insult, right? But it wasn't. He's just asking a question. So when there's attack in our minds, right? He didn't mean to, he wasn't attacking you, right? That, not from his perspective. So when there's attack in our minds, that kind of thing happens. And we call these miscommunication. Miscommunication. So we do suffer both from actual manifestations and from imagined manifestations. when we're out of harmony with the Tao. And really, when this says there is no greater loss than losing the Tao, what this is trying to say is that that's unnecessary. It's unnecessary suffering. No greater curse than covetousness, right? To covet something is to want it. No greater curse than covetousness. Whenever you are not happy with what is as it is, you're perceiving lack. And if you perceive lack and you believe in lack, guess what you get to experience? Lack in one way or another. You know, the ways to experience lack are varied. You know, you could experience lack as nobody loves me. You could experience lack as I don't have enough money to pay my bills. You could experience lack as I'm not as good as other people. I don't have the skills that other people do. You know, the way to experience lack probably goes on and on and on and on. But what we don't see is it's a perfect reflection of wanting, because in order to want, there has to be lack. Right? There has to be lack in order to want. So it's a curse that we are putting on ourselves whenever we're not happy with things as they are. In fact, I don't know if I can find it quickly. There's a verse at the near the end of the Tao. Let me see if I can find it. It's in the 80s, I think. Again, not only in the 80s, it is verse 80. it says, if a country is governed wisely, which means in accordance with the Tao, its inhabitants will be content. They enjoy the labor of their hands and don't waste time inventing labor-saving machines. In other words, they don't want it to be done differently. They're happy with the way it's done. They enjoy the labor of their hands and don't waste time inventing labor-saving machines. Since they dearly love their homes, they aren't interested in travel. There may be a few wagons and boats, but these don't go anywhere. There may be an arsenal of weapons, but nobody ever uses them. People enjoy their food, take pleasure in being with their families, spend weekends working in their gardens, delight in the doings of the neighborhood, and even though the next country is so close that people can hear its roosters crowing and its dogs barking, they are content to die of old age without ever having gone to see it. Now, to the wrong mind, that may sound pretty boring, but what this is really describing is absolute satisfaction with what is. No wanting at all. No sense of lack at all. Complete fulfillment right here, right now with what's here. Sometimes that's called bliss. So there is no greater loss than losing the Tao, and no greater curse than covetousness. No greater tragedy than discontentment. This is just another way of saying the same thing. The worst of faults is wanting more, always. Not just wanting more, but wanting more, always. You can never be free as long as you want. And some of you guys know the story that this past summer, my desiring for the future died. And I've noticed a big change in me. And it doesn't mean that I'm not still planning for the future, because, you know, Ron and I are again working on I think we're going to build a house in Beulah. We haven't bought the lot yet, but certainly what I do is I pay attention to him, his signs, right? And his signs right now seem to be pointing in that direction. And so I think that's where we're going. But, you know, it could turn in a dime. I don't know. And I'm playing along with him. And playing along with him is he gives me these stacks of books. And, you know, go through these and pick out what cabinets you want. Okay, so I go through the books and I pick out what cabinets I want, right? I mean, that's what he told me to do. And the difference is on the inside. You know, before there was this, I could even see it. As it died, I could see it. I couldn't see it while I still had it. I could only see it when it died. It's kind of like Bernadette Roberts says, you could see it when it was gone. What I could see is before there was this desire, which was like an energy pushing out into the world, this energy that pushes out into the world. I don't know how else to describe it. It's an outward energy, a very strong outward energy. And that's gone. There's just this absolute contentment here, even though I can still, you know, play along with planning a dream house. It's that energy of wanting that used to be there is gone. And I think this is why I can meditate longer. Because used to, when I was meditating, there was always this little thought of something else that needed to be done or would be more pleasurable. You know, like I used to have a hard time meditating on a gorgeous day because that outward energy wanted to be outside enjoying this day, right? It didn't want to be inside sitting in a chair with the eyes closed. But when that outward energy is gone, there's this huge obstacle that's gone. It doesn't mean I won't ever go outside and take a walk. I'll probably go outside and take a walk as soon as I finish teaching. I'll listen to Jacqueline and take a walk. But, go check the mail. You know, here in La Vida, we can walk. I'm on one side of town, and the mail's on the other side of town, and I will walk over and check the mail, and it won't even take the whole hour, even in a foot of snow. That's kind of the essence of the Tao right there. You know, being totally satisfied with my afternoon walk to get the mail. And I already did the meditation this morning, and I loved it, and there'll be another one tomorrow morning. And I love it. But I can see that I'm ready to meditate because I don't want something else. I can see that wanting something else is an obstacle because then you have to use your time differently, right? So there's no greater tragedy than discontentment. The worst of faults is wanting more, always. The worst of faults is wanting more, always. Contentment alone is enough. Again, be happy with what is. That doesn't mean life is going to stop. I think that's what people are afraid of. I think people think if I quit wanting, life is going to stop. And like I said, as far as I can tell, I'm still probably going to get another house. You know, like it hasn't stopped a thing. You know, I've acquired so many houses in the last few years, my head's starting to spin. But being happy with what is, even as what is keeps changing, is a really sweet place to be. In fact, the next sentence says, indeed, the bliss of eternity can be found in your contentment. So being happy with what is, even while one is, what is continues to change, but you're always happy with what's now and what's now and what's now. Like you don't need it to be different. It keeps changing. It's going to be different. That's what the world does. It's not like you're happy with what is and so everything's going to stall. It's not really like that last verse in the Tao, you know, where nobody travels anywhere and no new machines are invented. You know, that's just an image of how satisfied you are. But in reality, the world keeps moving, but you're just happy in every second. You know, it keeps moving and you're the one that's still. Your contentment is still. and it's not dependent on anything. Let's see, we have 8 minutes left, and I think the only person I've looked at on verse 46 is Wayne, so let's just check and see if anybody else has anything different to add to verse 46. Since I have Stephen here, we'll look at him. Oh, we looked at his first paragraph because he modernized it. When a country is in harmony with the Tao, the factories make trucks and tractors. When a country goes counter to the Tao, warheads are stockpiled outside the cities. Now, he does say it differently because Wayne Dyer was all about wanting. Listen to what Stephen Mitchell says. There is no greater illusion than fear. So he focuses on something different. Instead of focusing on wanting, he focuses on fear. There is no greater illusion than fear. You know, I know people who are always worrying about something. And what's really interesting about that is at least 99% of what they worry about, if not 99.8% of what they worry about, never happens. And yet they keep on worrying anyway. Peace Pilgrim talked about this in her book. She talked about the worry habit. That's what she called it, the worry habit. And the people that I know that worry, they suffer. They're not happy worrying. They suffer a lot. And as soon as one thing works out, because that's what's funny about these people, at least the ones I know, I can see things working out for them, you know. So as soon as the one thing they were worrying about works out, so they don't have that to worry about anymore, they just grab on to the next thing to worry about. It really is a worry habit. He says there's no greater illusion than fear. No greater illusion than fear. And, you know, one person that I'm thinking of in particular who I know quite well, there's nothing at all wrong in her life. Her life is perfect, I mean, even by the mind standards. And yet she worries all the time. So that is an illusion, isn't it? You can't even see how, you know, again, even by the mind standards, how good everything is, how wonderful everything's working out, how the universe is just plodding along perfectly, and you're fearing that next time, that's when it's not going to. You know, next time, next, it's always about the future. No greater illusion than fear. Then he says, there's no greater wrong than preparing to defend yourself. That reminds me of A Course in Miracles. When I defend myself, I am attacked. And you are, because that's why you're defending yourself. You perceive yourself as attacked. You know, you perceive that somebody else thinks you're stupid or dumb or inadequate or, you know, lazy or whatever. So instead of noticing your own self-judgments in your own mind and realizing they're yours so you can let them go, you project them out onto others, and then you plan your defense. And he says, there's no greater misfortune than having an enemy. I agree with that too. I don't understand why everybody doesn't like everybody. And I mean that genuinely. I was telling Cheryl and Jacqueline yesterday in a meeting that, you know, I've heard people say many, many times, I have to love them, but I don't have to like them. And the truth is, when you love them, you will like them. That's the truth. That's how you know you don't love them, is you don't like them. That's how you know. It doesn't mean that you don't still see how they cause their own suffering. You know, because you can see how people cause their own suffering. But that doesn't make you not like them. You don't like them when you think they cause your suffering. That's when you don't like them. Right? You're actually causing your own suffering with your thoughts, but you're projecting it out to them, and you're saying, I don't like, you know, him or her. When you are no longer doing that, you will like everyone. Everyone. I promise. Like and love are really synonymous. So there's no greater misfortune than having an enemy. And again, all of these things that he's pointed to are errors in your mind. There's no greater illusion than fear. You're the one having negative fantasies about the future. There's no greater wrong than preparing to defend yourself. You're the one that's attacking yourself in your own mind and now preparing to defend. And there's no greater misfortune than having an enemy. You're the one that's believing the thoughts that's causing you not to like that person. All three of those point right back at you. And he's kind of saying this is a waste. It's a waste that you should create so much unhappiness for yourself. Think about it. It's a waste that you should create so much unhappiness for yourself. And why would you want to? I mean, how many of you, when you get up in the morning, or how many of you, some of y'all have set goals for the year because you went to the Resolving for Truth retreat. How many of y'all have a goal on your action plan that says create unhappiness for myself this year? Yeah, nobody. Nobody. And nobody gets up with that intention. Nobody gets up with that intention in the morning. Boy, today I'm going to see how much unhappiness I can create for myself. Sometimes I think they get up with the intention, I'm going to see how much unhappiness I can create for him or her. But in the process, they create it for themselves too, right? So it's a waste for us to have negative fantasies about the future, to worry, for us to attack ourselves within our mind, but hide behind the illusion of defending ourselves against others, and to have these thoughts about other people that cause us not to like them. I mean, how many of you guys have not liked someone and felt perfectly happy at the same time? No? Not really, not perfectly happy. You can't not like someone and be perfectly happy at the same time. Whoever can see through all fear will always be safe. Whoever lets go of these errors in their own mind will always be happy. Will always be content. So that's all the time we have. So I was going to say next week I'll start on 47, but actually I won't be here next week, Don. I have to pick my mom up at the airport. So next week I won't be here. And I'm not sure. I think the week after I might even be in retreat. So it might be a few weeks before I'm back. But when I get back, we will start 47, okay? Everybody have a good time. Jacqueline, I'll be trudging in the snow and listening to every word that you say. Bye.